Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Dr. Paul Pillar, who retired in 2005 after a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. His last position was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He was previously served a variety of analytical and managerial positions, including the chief of the analytical units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He's also the author of a number of books, Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process. And he's also now the visiting professor of Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. And this week, he testified along with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff of Colin Powell, and Colonel Sam Gardner, both of whom have been regular guests on this program. He testified before the National Security and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee chaired by Henry Waxman, where they looked into the likelihood and consequences of a U.S. military strike on Iran. And then we'll go to Pakistan and speak with Salman Raja, who's a senior partner in a Pakistani law firm based in Lahore. Mr. Raja is a graduate of Punjab University, Cambridge University, Harvard Law School, and the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And he's a highly respected legal professional in Pakistan who was arrested under the emergency decree of November the 3rd, 2007, held for 5 days before being released on bail. He's authored an article widely available on the internet entitled Pakistan Inside the Storm, where he suggests that the motive that both Musharraf and Bhutto, the civilian kleptocrat and the military dictator, have something in common, which is neither of them have made a deal to suppress, particularly in Bhutto's case, have the Supreme Court not deal with her previous corruption charges, to have that slate wiped clean. We'll also speak with Dr. Brenda Ekwerzel, who's a climate scientist at the Global Environmental Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's the leading member of the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate Science Education Program, which is designed to strengthen support for strong federal climate legislation and U.S. climate policies. And this, of course, is in the context of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that just released its report a couple of days ago, yesterday, in Valencia, where the UN chief has called for the United States and China to show a strong leadership in the face of an evidence that indicates a growing urgency vis-a-vis the effects of CO2 on the planet and specifically on climate change. I'm now speaking with Dr. Paul Pillar, who retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He previously served in a variety of analytical and managerial positions, including as Chief of the Analytical Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, Persian Gulf, and South Asia. Professor Pillar also served in the National Intelligence Council as one of the original members of its analytical group. He's been the Executive Assistant to the CIA's Deputy Director of Intelligence and Executive Assistant to the Director of Central Intelligence, William Webster. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group for the DCI's Counterterrorist Center from 1997 to 1999 and was Deputy Director of that center. He was a Federal Executive Fellow at the Brookings Institution from 1999 to 2000, and he retired from the United States Army Reserve and served in active duty from 71 to 73, including a tour in Vietnam. He's the author of the books Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process. He's now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. And this week, along with Colonel Wilkerson and Colonel Sam Gardner, he testified before the House's National Security and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, chaired by Henry Waxman. And Dr. Pillar, this week the Chinese were a no-show at the attempts to bring about a sanctions regime against Iran for its continued nuclear program, and that certainly doesn't look good. And in the interim, before a shot is fired, if you will, already the rumors of war have created an environment which appears to have rewarded the Iranian leader Ahmadinejad. His recent budget was predicated upon $60 oil. Now it's up to about 100. So this is quite a windfall for this unpopular president in Iran, who's now able to reduce the threats from his own people who were angry at fuel shortages, etc.
Well, the good morning, Ian. The atmosphere of hostility and tension between the United States and Iran plays into Ahmadinejad's hands and into the hands of the hardline elements of which he is the most familiar face in more than one respect. You mentioned the impact of price of oil. That's one. But also his vein of political sentiment, the hardline persuasion in Iran, is based in large part on, or draws its political strength from, the whole concept of confrontation with and threat from the United States. So insofar as Washington appears to be that much more hostile and to be doing more saber-rattling, as we seem to have done in recent weeks, that does tend to strengthen the political message of that end of the Iranian spectrum.
So many people argue that and there are leaks from high-ranking military officers suggesting that people, for example, the CENTCOM commander and others, are not, and the military itself feels overstretched, particularly the Army and Marines who are tied down in Iraq, that there really isn't a stomach for a war against Iran, even a limited air war. You hear these rumors, but isn't it equally true that there's the possibility of stumbling into this, given the large military and naval presence in the Gulf, the war next door? Isn't it possible that we could do this, you know, by accident? In other words, a Revolutionary Guard speedboat could collide with an aircraft carrier, and then it's, you know, God knows what.
It's not only possible, but it's what I worry about the most right now. I don't believe, and maybe I'm being unduly optimistic, I don't believe the administration and the president specifically intends to make a decision over the next 14 months to start a new war. And I don't believe I certainly don't believe that's the intent on the other side, given Iran's conventional inferiority to us. But you're absolutely right. There are any number of incidents that could occur that might touch off military clash without the intent of either side to launch a war. And we can see some episodes in the past that would give us an idea of the sort of thing that might occur. Recall the accidental shooting down of an Iranian civilian airliner near the end of the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. That was a case of tragic mistaken identity by a U.S. warship, but many Iranians even to this day believe it was done intentionally and leading to the loss of over 200 Iranian lives. Then we had more recently the incident, which was more deliberate on the Iranians' part, but this is the sort of thing that could get out of control, of the capture of the British seamen down near the northern end of the Gulf, and they were held captive, as you recall, for a week or so. Those sorts of things, as well as any kind of, as you say, bumping of boats in the Persian Gulf, could easily lead to a larger conflagration.
So, Dr. Pillai, given that the Chinese were a no-show at the Security Council meeting on a sanctions regime or a stepped-up sanctions regime, when the president said that that is the track that he's on now and that they won't take the military option off the table because that's sort of the way business is done, I guess, to have some leverage. But the long and the short of it is that would indicate the Chinese no-show would indicate that that's not particularly going anywhere. So what chances do you give, if you take the president at his word, that sanctions first?
Well, you mentioned the Chinese dimension. We could also talk about the Russians. That is a problem. And with regard to China, it has developed a substantial economic relationship with Iran. You could even call it a strategic relationship in many ways. and I can't remember the exact percentage, but a substantial proportion of China's oil imports now come from Iran. I think it's something like about 18 or 20%, if I recall. And the Russians have their own economic equities, which reflect some of the traditional, going back to the Russian Empire, pre-Soviet Union, traditional Russian interest in getting influence to the south, access to the warm water ports, and all those sorts of things. And indeed, those are challenges for diplomacy. But I think the biggest stumbling block to progress in making sanctions work and resulting in a peaceful accommodation with Iran is not just the Russian and Chinese perspective, but our own very narrow perspective toward negotiations and toward being willing to discuss things of concern to Iran as well as to us. I mean, look what we have on the table right now. Besides the a couple of rounds of very limited in terms of scope and agenda talks that Ambassador Crocker has had with his Iranian counterpart in Baghdad, in which have consisted mainly of our side telling the Iranians what we don't like about their behavior in Iraq. The other thing we have on the table is to say if they make the key concession on the nuclear issue, suspending uranium enrichment, then we'd be willing to sit down and join the Europeans and talk. Well, that doesn't sound like a very attractive trade. They make the key substantive concession, and in return, we're just willing to sit and take our seat at the table. I would draw a contrast here with our previous experience with Libya, which was a success story. I give the Bush administration and the Blair government a lot of credit for seizing this opportunity, which resulted in the tripartite Libyan-U.S.-British agreement of some almost 4 years ago, which led to the opening up and dismantling of the Libyan unconventional weapons program, as well as turning them from an adversary to a partner on counterterrorism. And the key difference was, between Libya and so far Iran, we talked with the Libyans. We had secret talks that went back to 1999 under the Clinton administration, and the agenda was open. We discussed things of concern to us, unconventional weapons programs and terrorism, and we discussed things of concern with the Libyans, and the result was successful. So to make sanctions work in the Iranian case, we not only have to do a lot of hard slogging diplomatically with the likes of the Chinese and Russians, but also have to consider the other half of the equation. What is the incentive for Iran to improve its behavior? And I'm afraid so far we haven't given them much incentive.
Well, of course, Dr. Pillai, Iran is a member of the Axis of Evil, and on many occasions, when we had an opportunity to talk to them through back channels when they approached the United States, according to Colonel Wilkerson, who testified with this week before the House, Colonel Wilkerson told me that at the point where we had maximum leverage at the time when the Statue of Saddam came down and the Iranians thought perhaps that they'd be next on the list and before the invasion of Iraq turned sour, they apparently approached us through the Swiss and said, look, everything's on the table. We have authority from the Supreme Leader. And Vice President Cheney gave them the back of his hand, suggesting that we don't talk to evil. And that appears to be the instructions that Stephen Hadley's been giving, which is if they approach us and say something that's useful, we'll take it, but that doesn't mean anything more. And then the meeting that recently took place between Ryan Crocker and the Iranian delegation, one of the people in attendance on the Iranian side was the Revolutionary Guard officer that apparently was the target of the raid on the consulate in Erbil. We failed to get him, but he showed up at the meeting, which I think on the Iranian side is a clear insult to us, is it not?
Yeah, it certainly is. And the other recent development was, you know, we did release some of the Iranians that had been captured in Erbil and another operation elsewhere in Iraq. I would not only did we, I think, lose an opportunity in 2003, which is what you were mentioning, but I would turn the clock back even farther than that. There was a wonderful window of opportunity in the immediate wake of 9/11, and we should recall that 9/11 was firmly denounced by the Iranian regime. I mean, the attack was. That was followed by our intervention in Afghanistan, Operation Enduring Freedom, And for a brief, wonderful period, we were working in close and effective cooperation with the Iranians on Afghan matters, where we were on the same side. We had been on the same side for some time against the Taliban and in favor of the what was then called the Northern Alliance. And you can ask people like Ambassador Jim Dobbins or Ambassador Khalilzad, who were working on this problem at the time, that we had a good cooperation with the Iranians. And I have no doubt that the Iranians hoped that type of cooperation would continue on other matters, not least of all on Iraq, you know, the other foe which we shared, this one to their west, Saddam Hussein, just like the Taliban was a foe that we shared to their east. But it was then, just not much later, that we heard the Axis of Evil speech and the basis for cooperation. Well, we removed it, and a lot of hopes went unrealized. So, yes, there have been big missed opportunities in the past.
And what do you think of this talk of the of Representative Abercrombie's of the House passing some resolution to prevent the president from an attack, if indeed one is in the offing?
Well, I would be fully in support of Congress asserting its constitutional role, and such a resolution might well be useful. I think the sorts of hearings at which Larry Wilkerson and Sam Gardner and I testified this past week are also useful. We have to recall that, you know, before March 2003, and actually going back to the fall of 2002, when the administration was gearing up for the war in Iraq, and we did have the one congressional vote, which is commonly referred to as a war resolution in the fall of 2002, Congress, to be quite blunt, and I'm not singling out one party or the other, really was both, rolled over and played dead. And if you want to sort of review the bidding on this, you might go back and read the chapter on Congress's role in Thomas Ricks's book, Fiasco, which I think paints a very accurate picture and squares with my experiences at the time. There was a, well, it wasn't just Congress, it was the press and the American public and all of us in various ways who did not ask the good, hard, tough questions. And so I am pleased that at least some members of Congress and some committees are taking that initiative with regard to Iran, so we wouldn't have a repeat of the same experience.
But earlier we were talking, Dr. Piller, about the notion that this could be a bit, you know, something akin to Barbara Tuchman's The March of Folly, where the confrontation is in place and there's a stalemate, but any accident could trigger a wider conflagration. It seems to me that what's happening in Iraq with this lull that's going on now as a result of the surge, which seemed to be more than anything a belated recognition on the part of the U.S. that the Sunnis wanted to make a deal with us, ostensibly because they figured that both sides are fighting the wrong enemy and they want to basically keep their powder dry and go after the Persians, which is how they refer to the Shia. And if indeed the other shoe is going to drop at some point, because the Iraqi government or so-called government is totally feckless and doesn't appear to be capable of delivering anything, so that the truce that the Sunnis now have would seem to be very tenuous. And if indeed they do go after, you know, try and retake Baghdad, for example, which the Ambaris are threatening to do, how could the United States, either stuck in a civil war or trying to be on the sidelines, how could they not prevent the Iranians from intervening?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily in Iran's interest, as they would view it, to intervene in some traditional big way with the battalions, you know, rolling across the border. Iran is already intervening in Iraq in a big way, but more irregular and less visible ways. There's no question that the Iranians, have been cultivating as much influence as they can with a very wide variety of Iranian groups, mostly but not exclusively Shia. We see, you know, little bits of evidence of the material support they have given that have been underscored with regard to the explosively formed penetrators and so on, but they're doing much else as well. Iran has a extremely strong interest in Iraq. This is the power right next door. It is the country that, under Saddam Hussein, launched a war in the 1980s that resulted in hundreds of thousands of Iranians dying. So, of course, they've got a very strong interest. As long as we're there, there might be, you know, more hesitation with regard to something like a conventional military intervention. But I think even after we've gone, Iran's strengths, the main tools they would have going for them, tend to be the more asymmetric ones, as we say, not a conventional military intervention, but based on the fact that a majority of Iraqis are Shia Arabs, that these indirect, less visible means of influence may be what continues to work in their favor.
Well, of course, there's no point in expecting them to want us to succeed. They clearly don't. And since we're obviously in trouble there, I'm just wondering what our options are. Chaz Freeman, the diplomat, said that the bottom line is that we have an unsuccessful military occupation of Iraq and the Iranians have a successful political occupation.
Chaz's summation is a good one. The Iranians' motives in Iraq are mixed. On the one hand, they are no doubt happy to see us, at least for the time being, bleed for a while. On the other hand, they do not, and this is the part where they have a shared interest with us, they do not have an interest in seeing unending and escalating disorder and violence right there on their western border. So they prefer not to get things out of hand. This is the part of the equation that I think would change if we did have a military clash directly with Iran. Whatever restraint they may have been exerting so far in Iraq, and indeed we've had these recent reports that there are fewer of these explosively formed penetrators coming across the border, whether that is a reflection of conscious Iranian decisions to exercise restraint, I don't know. But the incentive for them to exercise restraint would suddenly go down sharply if indeed we did have a military clash in the Gulf. The Iranians no doubt have been planning the various ways in which they would respond to us asymmetrically if that occurred. Larger international terrorism at the hands of their own state agents or perhaps allies like Lebanese Hezbollah would be one way. But right next door in Iraq, where the Iranians, could make life far more difficult for us than they have to date, is another area in which they no doubt would respond asymmetrically.
Well, in terms of my analysis that they were going through a temporary truce now in Iraq, yeah, with the Sunni essentially keeping their powder dry.
Yes.
They've gone after al-Qaeda, who were a kind of marriage of convenience at any rate, that they're giving the Shiite-dominated government a chance to make it a political deal, and presumably that's what the U.S. is pressuring them into doing. But you get the feeling that if nothing happens, and most people think that this government's incapable of delivering anything, that truce will be over, and then they'll go at it again. So if that happens, how are the chips going to fall?
You mean in terms of the internal civil war in Iraq?
Yes, exactly. Wouldn't it be, in fact, what we've seen so far would be, you know, small potatoes compared to that?
I would generally agree with that. I agree with your analysis, Ian, that people are keeping their powder dry, and I think this is one of the explanations. There are other things having to do with the surge, but one of the explanations for the reduction by several measures in insurgent and activity and civil strife. I think the big timetable that is on the minds and increasingly on the minds of Iraqis of all factions is how much more time does the Bush administration have in office? And now the countdown is to 14 months. You know, one of the arguments that's often been made, as you're aware, against setting some kind of timetable for withdrawal of U.S. forces is, the bad guys would just wait us out, and so they would hold back for the time being, but then once we get out, all heck would break loose. Well, January 20th, 2009 presents us with a timetable of sorts, whether we like it or not, and I think Iraqis of any astuteness at all and of whatever political stripe of all, as they view American politics and the course of American policy, this is going to be the most salient aspect of the American political scene, that the Bush administration has only 14 months left. And the main driving force in pursuing the policy that we continue to pursue has been the determination of one George W. Bush, and that the prospect for what will come after January 20th, 2009, even though people like Senator Clinton, the leading candidate on the Democratic side, you know, is not speaking about anything close to a total withdrawal, but having to keep troops there for the time being and so on. Anyone who reads opinion polls, I think, can see that that milestone of a change of administration in another 14 months is a major one. So yes, I think you're absolutely right, and the prospects for a heightened civil war after that, as we draw down farther, are there. But let me emphasize, that's something that's going to happen in any case. Whether the drawdown occurs a year and a half from now, or 2 years from now, or 3 years from now, a lot of what we see when we talk about the prospects for heightened civil war in Iraq, and make no mistake, we already have a civil war, although it's had its ups and downs and ebbing and flowing. That was there as a result of the ethnic and political geography and conflicts of Iraq that the Saddam dictatorship had more or less kept a lid on, and it was going to be broken open regardless of the particular timetable of the U.S. troop presence. But the key date, I think, is January 2009.
But obviously, a lot's going to happen before then, Dr. Pillow. I mean, we've got this election, and you could make the argument that the Democrats' tactics so far have been, certainly they've been unsuccessful in terms of restraining the president in any way. And it seems that as long as the Democrats have all their eggs in the basket of saying, you know, we've got to withdraw troops, that makes it easy for the president to make a cosmetic withdrawal sometime in the next summer to help the beleaguered Republicans in the election. And I would make the argument that that's tactically for the Democrats rather boneheaded, because the real issue seems to me, where the president is vulnerable, is we should all be asking this administration for accountability for its actions so far, as well as asking them what is their strategy. It seems to me that we're in this mess because they either have a flawed strategy or no strategy, or certainly a strategy that they've never explained. And surely it's overdue and time for them to explain.
Well, of course it is. But I was speaking to Iraqi perceptions, and we should remember this war has been going on now for over 4.5 years, and this remaining time in the current administration is only slightly more than a year. I mean, that's barely a blink in the of the eyelash in terms of any planning that Sunni insurgents or other elements in Iraq, not to mention the Iranian regime and other outsiders in the region, are doing. We really are in the last act of the administration. There will be, as you say, a cosmetic drawdown of troops simply because the surge is going to come to an end. And for, if no other reason, the unavailability of forces and the conclusion of tours and the inability, short of leaning even harder on the guard and the reserve and so on, to cut short their stateside time, all of that adds up to the fact that we're going to have a lesser troop level in the middle of next year than we have right now. And yes, that can work in favor of the Republicans along the lines that you suggested, because the trajectory will be, or at least appear to be, what the American people in the opinion polls show they favor. Nonetheless, it's not going to go much farther than that, and I would predict that on January 19th, 2009, we're still going to have something in the neighborhood of 100,000 troops or so there, perhaps even more.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Paul Pillow.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Dr. Paul Pillow, who's retired from the CIA in 2005. after a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. His last position was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, and he's also currently now a visiting professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University, and he testified this week before the House National Security and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, chaired by Henry Waxman, where he testified along with Colonel Wilkerson and Colonel Gardner, both of whom have been regular guests on this program, where they discuss the likelihood and the consequences of a U.S. military strike on Iran. And I'm now speaking with Salman Raja, who is a senior partner in a Pakistani law firm based in Lahore. Mr. Raja is a graduate of Punjab University, Cambridge University, Harvard Law School, and the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. He's a highly respected and experienced legal professional in Pakistan who was arrested under the emergency decree of November the 3rd, 2007, and was held for 5 days before being released on bail. He's authored an article widely available on the internet at opensociety.net, entitled Pakistan Inside the Storm. And of course, Salman, this is the 13th time in the short 60-year history of Pakistan where emergency rule has been imposed. But from the point that you're making is that Benazir Bhutto, who has pretty good public relations in this country and is seen by many as something of a savior, she has a rather, shall we say, sleazy motive in this. One, she made a pretty sleazy deal with Musharraf in the first place. And the purpose of one of the main points of that deal was that he promised her that corruption cases against her would be dismissed. So I take it that your feeling is that she has a real motive in keeping the Supreme Court essentially under the thumb of whoever the next leader is.
That's correct. I think that is a view that's widely held in Pakistan. And most people have been skeptical of her, even over the last few days when she's come out with a much stronger line against General Musharraf than in the past. But the jury is still out whether she really means it or whether she's just upping the ante to improve her bargaining position with General Musharraf. So we are still, the country as a whole is waiting to see how she will actually play her cards in the end. But as you rightly say, she really has a past and a background that she does want to conceal. And there was a clear deal with General Musharraf early in the autumn. Early in October, he issued a decree whereby all corruption cases in which she was involved were shelved, and the state essentially undertook not to prosecute her. And on that basis, she has filed an appeal in Switzerland before the Swiss judicial authorities, seeking a dismissal of prosecutions in Switzerland on the ground that in her home country, the actions that she's alleged to have undertaken or committed are no longer being considered crimes. Therefore, she should not be prosecuted in Switzerland either. So it's a very sad situation that somebody who has real political support, real mass support, and who many people do want to look up to, has a motive in this and has a background that is holding a lot of people back from fully coming out and supporting her.
So if this is the politics of opportunism on her part, where she made a deal, a previous deal with Musharraf, and now that Musharraf's clumsy handling, shall we say, of the situation has put him on the defensive, and it seems to me that I can't see how he's going to survive all of this, that she is the winner, if you will, by default. But does that mean that she will have wide support? And secondly, does that mean that she'll ever be able to do anything that she promises, which is to go after the religious extremists? Because after all, so far, the only people that Musharraf's been going after have been people like you, the secular professionals.
Well, that is correct. But we must keep in mind that the real power in Pakistan remains the military. Whoever the civilian facade might be, or whatever the civilian facade might be, it is the military that calls the shots in the end. So until and unless the military really decides to let go of power, it's going to be very hard to dislodge General Musharraf. at the moment, we do not have a mass uprising that would throw him out of the presidency. And additionally, there is again, as we speak, talk of a renewed deal between General Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto under the, if you like, auspices of Mr. Negroponte, who's in Pakistan and who's very busy these days in Pakistan, speaking with a number of people, including Benazir Bhutto and General Musharraf. So we are really waiting to see whether Mr. Negroponte will be able to put the deal between the two back on track. If that happens, then General Musharraf may well survive his various violations of the Constitution and his clumsy handling of the situation notwithstanding. So it's, in that sense, a situation where I think outside powers are playing a role, and one hopes and wishes that that role will be a responsible one and ultimately one that benefits democracy and the creation of constitutional institutions in this country. Because you cannot have a country fighting a major war against terrorism or against religious extremisms while its own civilian institutions are imploding inside the country.
So, Salman Rajah, what is the situation, as much as you can divine here, in terms of Musharraf standing with the rest of the military? I mean, I understand that his hold on power may have something to do with the fact that he's been able to attract at least $11 billion of U.S. Money to the Pakistani military. Also, the Sunday's New York Times indicates that perhaps President Bush's handling or mishandling of this situation is largely to do with his personal relationship with the Musharraf, who apparently he really bonded with. So the question is, I cannot believe that it's General Musharraf who really delivers the money so much as whoever's in charge of the military that delivers the money. So are there any other people in the ranks who would feel that Musharraf has mishandled this whole situation? I understand that when he appears on television now, he's sort of more petulant than he is powerful. So what's any rumors in that regard?
Well, at the moment, there is no sign that the U.S. is going to pull back any of the cash inflows into the country. And until that happens, I do not see the military ranks really being perturbed. I would say that both the military hierarchy and President Bush are comfortable with the status quo, and the status quo being General Musharraf. They both feel that they can deal with General Musharraf. He's somebody that the U.S., the Bush administration, has invested in and feels a certain degree of comfort dealing with. And similarly, the military hierarchy feels that he's been able to deliver so far. And you're quite right to point to the very large cash inflows into the country, much of which has benefited the military hierarchy. So at the moment, General Musharraf is delivering at both ends. He's keeping the Bush administration, or has up till now, kept the Bush administration reasonably comfortable with him as a person and his handling of the situation overall, and the ease with which he has allowed the U.S. to maneuver inside Pakistan. And the military hierarchy also feels that he's been successful in ensuring a steady flow of money into the country. So until and unless there is a credible threat of that inflow being disrupted on account of General Musharraf's handling or mishandling of the situation, the military high command might not take a decisive step. But we need to wait and see, because he has said that he will retire from the military by the end of maybe this month or sometime during December. Now, once that happens, a whole new set of forces will be unleashed. There will be people within the military who might well then want to take a different look at General Musharraf and who might treat him differently then. But so far, there is very little sign of any overt dissent within the military.
But if indeed, I mean, I'm under the impression that the Pakistani people are chafing under the unpleasant choices that they've had politically between civilian kleptocrats and military leaders. And as I mentioned earlier, this is the 13th time in the short 60-year history of Pakistan that emergency rule has been decreed. And it would seem to me that if you look at the political choices that the Pakistani people have, Sharif had two chances and blew it. Bhutto had two chances and blew it. And it seems to me that now Musharraf has had his chance and blown it. And perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself now. But what's your feeling, in terms of being there in Pakistan on the street? Do the people have any faith in any of these leaders?
No, they don't. But it's a strange kind of state of helplessness. What do you do? You've got a repressive and increasingly repressive regime which is willing to really crack down. The lawyers' agitation or movement of the last few days has been hit particularly hard. They've really gone with very strong arm tactics, after the lawyers. They've physically, manhandled, beaten up a lot of people. A lot of people have been thrown into remote jails, given the worst conditions possible inside jail. So they've really aimed at breaking the will of the resistance to military rule in Pakistan. And until and unless the outside world takes concrete steps to dissuade General Musharraf, the people on their own might not be able to sustain or even raise the level of the movement against General Musharraf. You need to realize that most people here are desperately poor. Most people spend much of their time worrying about their next meal. For them to organize and participate over a long period of time in organized political activity, a movement or an agitation, is hard. Until and unless they have moral and maybe even physical support from somebody. And that, quite clearly, the outside powers, the U.S. and the EU at the moment, are not willing to provide. So that is a major issue. There is general mass revulsion in the country. Most people do not have faith any longer in General Musharraf's handling of the country. As you rightly say, the political parties have discredited themselves. The main political leaders have discredited themselves in the past. So it is a country which really is at the moment without direction. There is no obvious leader to channelize the anger, the revulsion that ordinary people feel here. It's a dangerous situation. It's a situation where splinter groups, terrorists, extremists can have a disproportionate impact on people's emotions, and new leaders can emerge, not all of them savory.
Well, it would seem that at this point, Salman Raja, that the jihadis are getting a free pass, this is a situation where they appear to be the only beneficiaries, and I don't know whether one's making too much of this, but I noticed when the cricket star Imran Khan visited the university recently, he was captured by the Islamic radical student body, indicating that he's not at all popular with those with that particular segment, and I'm just asking you, what's going on there in the universities? If the student body are not demonstrating with the lawyers, does that mean that they're sympathetic to the Islamists?
No, this was a peculiar situation. I think this needs to be understood because there is a major positive that has come out of this situation in the university in Lahore. Now, the student union that controls that particular university is an Islamist students' union, and I would say they're a proto-fascist organization. They really retain control over student politics in that university through coercion. And on that particular day, the way they behaved with Imran Khan was a bit of a surprise for this particular political leader. Because for the last several years, he has tried to cultivate the parent political party to which this Islamist Students' Union is affiliated. And there was generally the impression that Mr. Khan is close to the Jamaat Islami, parent body of the student union. What happened on that particular day was that the students' union and its parent political body got exposed as secretly being in in cahoots with General Musharraf, because they physically manhandled him and handed him over to the administration, to the police force, and thereby established the fact that the Islamist parties, despite their anti-Musharraf rhetoric, are really hand in glove with General Musharraf. It really has exposed the Musharraf regime and the opposition of the Islamist parties to General Musharraf. And what has come out very clearly is that the decades-old association between the Islamist parties, which started really with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, is still there. Despite appearances to the contrary, the military is still in cahoots with the Islamist parties, and that is one major area of concern for everybody, I would say the U.S. and also civil society within Pakistan. But what happened the very next day after this incident is unprecedented in the history of this particular university. On the very next day, 5,000 unaffiliated secular students spontaneously assembled in the university premises and ransacked the offices of this Islamist fascist party. And for the first time in decades, they made them physically vacate the university campus. Now, this is an expression of the real mood on the street in Pakistan. So it's wrong to say that the students are not with the lawyers or the students are not with the pro-democracy movement. What we saw a day after this particular incident was an expression, a spontaneous expression of what Pakistanis as a whole, or the majority of Pakistanis, actually are feeling at the moment. So that was a very major, major advance in terms of our political process here in Pakistan.
Well, just in closing, Salman Raja, that leads you in absolute dismay at the stupidity of the United States' political process, as much as we understand, because those students that you just talked about who got rid of the Islamic fascists and who asserted themselves, and you say reflect the majority of the Pakistani people, nobody in the United States appears to be talking to these people. We should be on their side. And instead, you're telling us that the guy that we're put all of our eggs in our basket with, Musharraf, is making secret deals with the Islamists while telling us, or telling our government, that he's going to crack down on them.
Absolutely. And I would say that this particular incident should be held up and should be placed before the administration in the U.S., and the administration in the U.S. should be questioned on this. And I'm sure they're aware of this at some level, but this is as stark a proof as you could hope for.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Salman Raja.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Salman Raja, who's a senior partner at a Pakistani law firm based in Lahore. He's a graduate of Punjab University, Harvard University's Law School, and Cambridge University, and the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And he was arrested under the emergency decree on November the 3rd, 2007. He's written an article available at opensociety.net, Pakistan Inside the Storm. I'm now speaking with Dr. Brendel Eckwessel, who is a climate scientist in the Global Environmental Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. Climate policies. Prior to joining the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Eckwessel was on the faculty of the University of Arizona's Department of Hydrology and Water Resources, with a joint appointment in the Geosciences Department. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool which has been used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the deserts of the Southwest. Dr. Eckwessel completed her doctorate work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University and did postdoctoral research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. And Brenda, we have this situation now where just this Saturday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued their latest report from Valencia. The Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, has challenged the United States and China to accelerate their awareness of not just their awareness of global warming, but their response to it, suggesting that there's a greater urgency now with this new data. So does this mean that finally we're going to stop this ludicrous delaying tactic of arguing about whether global warming is real or not?
I think you really hit that it's very important. If you didn't pay attention to this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when the first three reports were issued, now that they have share the prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, that everyone should take a moment and listen to the science. The science is very clear from the IPCC that the globe is warming. It's unavoidable that we will have more heat in the pipeline, but more importantly, that human activities have caused most of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. And so it's really time to move on. And in fact, as you say, policy response of the major emitters of the world, including the United States, China catching up with the United States. The U.S. emits about 25% every year of the world's emissions of heat-trapping gases. We have a huge history of changing the climate by our actions, and it's time to accelerate the response because, in fact, since the IPCC last closed the doors on the science that can be admitted into the long process, we've had more reports of accelerated ice melt, accelerated retreat of the Arctic sea ice, more lands are becoming arid, and so on. These reports, the ocean is no longer able to keep pace with the amount of carbon dioxide and gases in the atmosphere.
So where does the U.S. government stand? Because it seems like the courts are way ahead of certainly the executive branch, and I'm not sure that the Congress is asserting itself in any particularly useful way. For example, the White House apparently tried to remove a section from this new report, Reasons for Concern. So that leaves one with real concern.
It does, and what is important to remember is that leaders of Congress are going to go to the very next important meeting in Bali, where the post-Kyoto negotiations, what are we going to do as a world to reduce our heat-trapping emissions after the Kyoto Protocol ends this December in Bali, and leaders of Congress who are promoting the most aggressive legislation for the federal government for deep reductions of heat-trapping gases by near-term targets 2020, 2030, and by 2050. And these leaders are going to be heading to Bali to try to tell the world that it's not just the executive who is branch of the United States who is working on this problem, but in fact many states are working on the problem, cities and now the congressional delegation, that part of our government is actively debating legislation as we speak.
So where does in terms of what you're trying to do at the Union of Conscientists, which is alert the public, strengthen support for strong federal action, so in terms of alerting the public, where do we stand? Because I still see in the newspaper these ads from these nobodies challenging Al Gore to a debate. Obviously, I think there's any question these people are being funded by industry groups, and they're using a tactic, unfortunately, that the right wing in this country have developed, which is to usurp attention by claiming an equal and opposite argument under this doctrine that paralyzes the media, known as there are two sides to every argument. In other words, you thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That seems to be the ritual. So, if you have a have a Holocaust denier, a Holocaust survivor on, you have to have a Holocaust denier. If you have interview somebody who is in favor of evolution, you have to have somebody in favor of intelligence design. It's also a tactic used by the lunatic fringe who believe the government was behind 9/11, where you're being forced to take their stuff seriously in the absence of any reason to do so. So where does it stand? As I say, I see these ads all the time from people challenging Al Gore to a debate.
That's right, and a debate is not the right format because it gives the impression that the science is still being debated on the core issues. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and many scientists around the world are very, very clear. What they are debating, I think you can liken it to, if the IPCC would be saying that a car is driving down the road and it looks like it's driving about 50 miles per hour or 55 miles per hour. But in fact, someone could get up and say, wait. We're still debating the science on whether it is a dark gray car or whether it's a dark green car. And that can be very distracting for the public, when in fact the debate is in the weeds of the very trying to understand what's going to happen in our backyard the regional climate, the more smaller scale regions, we're trying to work that out. But the broad scale picture, where policy needs to know that information, there is no doubt that human activity is contributing to accelerated warming. And what's very disturbing to us is that there are irreversible changes that we really need to keep in mind, that with just a little bit more warming, we place at risk maybe 30% of plant and animal species could face extinction. And if we do not act soon and within the next decade made investment decisions about the power plants we build, about the buildings, about the retrofitting, and so on, that we do to try to use energy more efficiently and not continue to pollute our atmosphere with heat-trapping gases, then we place at risk species. We place at risk some of the large ice sheets and whether or not they're going to melt back and have long-term melt that would raise sea levels a substantial amount. We could hold the line and try to prevent some of these longer-term irreversible consequences if we were to act and take meaningful action now.
But it seems to me that the impetus for global warming is being fed by what's happening so far in terms of global warming. In other words, it's a self-perpetuating, accelerating phenomenon where, you know, we have, because of climate change, you have more and more forest fires, you have droughts, and you have floods. So the droughts now are causing forest fires. The forest fires, which we've just had here in Los Angeles, put up enormous amounts of CO2. Now we learn that as a consequence of Katrina, the kill-off of this vast forest down in Louisiana is instead of it being a sink for CO2, now it's going to be putting out CO2 as these dead trees rot. It's almost like the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
That's right, because it gets very hard to catch up with the changes that are accelerating because of the very effects that you're seeing make it much worse. And another situation that makes it worse is that the oceans, as they warm, they will no longer absorb as much carbon dioxide. The ocean is one of the biggest sinks of the heat-trapping gas carbon dioxide. And already we are seeing that the ocean is not able to keep up. It's becoming more acidic, and it's not absorbing as much of this heat-trapping gas. So, in fact, part of the IPCC projections for our emissions and the atmospheric concentrations are already looking like the worst-case scenarios are more likely and the best-case scenarios are less likely because the ocean is not absorbing as much carbon dioxide. So what is hard is that the long-term consequences of species going extinct that we would regret, we dial in that scenario early in our actions, and we don't see it until maybe a couple decades hence. And so we're bequeathing to future generations a very different world unless we act responsibly now. And that's very difficult because we're at the beginning stage of this really rapid acceleration.
But just in closing then, it would seem to me that if the Arctic and Greenland ice shelf slips off the bedrock, and the same is true in Antarctica, that would be like dropping two huge ice cubes into a glass of water. The level will go up. Is it going to take this kind of Pavlovian catastrophe to wake people up?
Unfortunately, we would cross the point of no return before we would see the evidence of the ice sheets, because the models that we look at, we could cross that threshold as low as 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, or it could be 4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. If it's the worst case scenario, then we could cross that within this century, but we feel the impact of that for maybe a couple centuries or longer. And that's difficult to convey people.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Brenda Eckvessel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Brenda Eckvessel, who's the climate scientist at the in the Program of Global Environmental Studies at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the host. I'm the host, actually, believe it or not. Lewis Vandenberg is the producer. Elliot Fong is the assistant producer. Melissa Figueroa is the engineer. And, of course, Lick Duan is also our assistant producer.